Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Oh, hello, Scott.
Oh, hello, and Benjamin Richardson.
Hello, good morning.
And good afternoon, and good evening, and good night. We have all three of us finished Final Fantasy VII. I'm 100 hours in, finally got the platinum. Kill me. It is worth it, probably. And we're just going to dive into a full-on spoiler cast, because many people have asked us to do one. The ending is patently ridiculous. We haven't talked about it that much in real life, because we haven't been around each other in real life. So I'm just going to open with that. Full spoilers, obviously, for the game, so be aware. Josh, where did you come down on the ending multiple timeline insanity?
My lord, like, I've been trying to pass this thing out for a week, because I kind of feel like Charlie from It's Always Sunny, you know, when he's got like the board and connecting the conspiracies and stuff. Coming out of the end, I didn't know what was going on, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It was just the moment when I realized that the game isn't really for me, if that makes sense. It kind of is, but it isn't, because up until the very end, up until the final hour or so of the game, like, the game doesn't necessarily rely on you knowing the original game. There are a few character cameos that only really resonate if you have played the original. But for the most part, the story, it gives you everything you need to know. But then when it hits you with that final sort of twist with Fate and Destiny and Sephiroth and stuff, like, it trades on your knowledge of knowing who characters like Zaka is. Because obviously, you know, I don't know who that is outside of lists I've done and talking to you guys and stuff like that. So there was still a lot of those beats that hit for me. And I love it conceptually, but as a story contained within a single game, I don't think it's anywhere near as good as it could be. But the questions it raises and the things it does to the original narrative, I do like a lot. And I am really excited to see where it goes from here. But I don't know whether that's going to be the case for two long-time Final Fantasy VII fans.
Mm-hmm. See, that's really interesting that you say that, Josh, because I think the ending is a way of them being able to go forwards and create a game that isn't just for Final Fantasy VII fans. I think that specifically is the idea.
Well, this is why it's so confusing to me, because I do think you're right, but the way they do it at first makes you at least trades on some knowledge of you knowing what happened originally. Like, for me, this story would have been great had that final cutscene and that final boss thing come about 20 hours into a 40-hour story. It being at the end of game one leaves so many doors open and raises so many questions for someone who doesn't know the story that I wonder if they'd be willing to come back for part two, if that makes sense.
Let's drill down on this stuff. What are the things that made, what specifically did you feel like you didn't know? Because they do want you to be asking questions going forward. And if you look at where Midgar ends in the original one, you do have a bunch of questions. And even something like Zack with the black hair, like, you see fragments of him before you know exactly what his full role is. Like, you know, I think they want you asking questions.
The difference is that when you're playing the original game, you don't know that it's trying to remake an old game. So those mysteries are acceptable, and you expect the game to explain them later on. Whereas if you're coming to this, as Josh says, you just assume, well, this is some assumed knowledge that I don't have, so now I'm no longer on board. Particularly with the Zack thing, you're quite right. Like, that's teased in the first game, long before you actually find out who he is. You read about notes to do with him, you see little sort of flashbacks, Aerith mentions him. And that's all, that's it's basically the exact same mystery that Josh is going through now, only he's assuming that, like, he has to know that to understand it.
Yeah, because there's all the stuff that you, like, even in the moment where you were like, oh God, this is making me feel like I'm missing out on something. What was the stuff that made you feel that?
There was quite a lot because there were a few beats that sort of half hit, kind of tangentially and vaguely knowing what happened in the original, that I wish I could have experienced fully, like the Zack thing when I saw that he, you know, didn't like die, when I saw that Biggs was alive. I think those moments only really are effective if you know what happens to those characters originally. Like what seeing Biggs, if devoid of context in this, in this remake, being alive, it's kind of like, that's cool, but obviously it only holds real importance of the kind of whole universe ramifications if you know what the original is. And it's not, I want to be clear, like, I don't have a problem with them leaving mysteries open for the next game. My issue is that this very much feels like part one because very few character arcs or very few narrative arcs are resolved here. Like, you look at something that's established as a series, like the MCU or Lord of the Rings or something. Mm-hmm. All of those individual entries are part of a larger series, but each individual installment has its own sort of beginning and end. It's still self-contained in a way that it answers enough to make it a satisfying piece of the puzzle. Whereas this, I thought, was the exact opposite. All of the mysteries were tantalizing, don't get me wrong. What happened to all the characters, what the ending means, it's all interesting stuff. But it makes me more excited about part two than it does make me feel like I was satisfied by part one, because I've already uninstalled the game. I want to know what happens next. I'm not experiencing this as it is, because it does feel like I said, part one of a bigger whole, and I think that's fine, but I don't know.
It's sort of like going home from the theater at the end of act one and then coming back 2 years later for act two. It is exactly that. You're right. It doesn't, The Midgar arc itself isn't necessarily concluded well, particularly as you know you storm Shinra HQ and the president's dead, and then you take on Rufus, but then he's not eliminated; he's still there. It's not like that section is complete. The other thing, Josh, there's one big spoiler about Final Fantasy VII, which I'm pretty sure everybody in the world knows by now. One of the largest storyline beats to do with a main character who might or might not have an unfortunate incident involving a very long sword.
Yes.
I think a big part of this ending was trying to suggest that that could change, and I think even non-Final Fantasy VII fans would understand that. Did that resonate with you at all?
Yeah, that was the thing that when Scott started saying, you know, something big happens at the end that changes Final Fantasy forever, because I don't know when that happens in the original story, that moment, I wondered playing through it whether they'd moved it up or whether they weren't going to do it at all. So that was always at the back of my mind, because even though I haven't played the original is so entrenched in gaming culture as a whole that stuff like what we're skirting around right now is kind of, in a lot of ways...
Spoilercast.
Well, yeah, but it's not a spoiler for this game, is it, really? In a way.
We're going to have to get into the whole thing. I don't know, I guess.
All right, okay. I guess. I don't know.
We'll keep, even though that's like the big pop culture twist, we'll keep it specific to a Final Fantasy VII remake spoiler cast.
There's a screenshot of that on the back of the Final Fantasy VII box.
Right.
Well, it's the thing, isn't it?
It was in the trailers back in the day. It was like, oh, a love that can never be. And it's like literally shows that scene. So whatever. But yeah, if we keep it specific to the Final Fantasy VII remake, yes.
Yeah. Like it's an interesting point though, man, because Jim Sterling did a recent video on spoiler culture in general in Final Fantasy VII. And it was really, really spot on, because for as big of a moment in gaming history that is, there are still going to be loads of people playing this game who have no prior knowledge of that. Like if you're a teenager now, you might not know that that's a thing, because, you know, for as much as we care about old stuff, a lot of young people don't care about old stuff, and like that knowledge as time goes on just kind of, it gets sort of weaker and weaker in cultural circles though.
Wouldn't you say like the cultural impact of this particular moment, isn't it like the equivalent of saying Mufasa dies or Juliet drinks the poison? You know, it's like a thing that you have to know, surely.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You'd assume, Ben, but...
No one's going into Romeo and Juliet expecting, oh, maybe we'll make it. It's a tragedy. People know that.
Hey, if Tetsuya Nomura was directing it, it would be a series of flashbacks and flash-forwards. They very much set up this idea of multiple timelines, and, you know, you fight Whisper Harbinger and Viridi, Rubrum, and Krakeo, the three little mini demon things. If you scan them with Assess Materia, it says that they are entities born from a different timeline, from a different destiny. And they come about when someone messes with time. That someone is obviously Sephiroth.
Do you think this timeline bending is going to continue, or did you think this is the way of just getting that out of the way now?
I think it. I don't know. I think they needed a way to try and have their cake and eat it. They needed some way to separate the remake from the original. And I honestly love what they've done. I love that they find a way to set the remake off in its own direction. And it for me, it freed up a lot of the stuff that I really didn't like going through it the first time. In terms of assuming that this remake was replacing the original by separating it off and fracturing reality and time, it allows the original to just stay as this great, you know, totemic, amazing thing, and now we can go forward with crazy timey-wimey whatever the hell we want it to be in the remake, and I like that they're separate, so I think that this is their bridge point, and I assume they won't do more, but it does directly factor into the stuff with you know, with multiple characters and the little teasers that they have, the flash forwards and stuff, because I think they're literally saying, look, all of this is now on the table, and that unifies returning fans and newcomers, because none of us know what's going to happen.
Sorry, Josh,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I want to ask, like, you guys, because obviously for me, the ending with all of that timey-wimey stuff and, you know, defying destiny, that felt very disconnected from the Shinra plot. So I wonder whether, because that doesn't really, to my knowledge anyway, that doesn't really interact much with what Shinra's doing and what the eco-terrorists were doing and stuff, whether that plot from the original Final Fantasy is still going to go ahead warped by the changes that are made, but that allows them to redo the general through line of the original game while adding way more diversions and alterations and subversions on top of that.
Yeah, all the like cross-dimensional stuff, all that is obviously brand new. This, the second that like they rip a hole in space and time and walk through it, that's all brand new stuff. The main thrust of the original game is about Shinra, Hojo, the experiments, Sephiroth and Aerith, and who their parents are, and they're both, you know, like descended from these scientists and stuff like that, and they're both like battling for the planet. And it's like, I still think they'll go forward with that. But if you believe the theories, which I do, check the Remake Explained video. Sephiroth and Aerith are the only two characters that have full knowledge of what's went before. Like, Remake is pretty much a sequel. And I think they, like, going forward, they'll be the ones trying to alter Destiny's course. But I don't know, like, if you're Tetsuya Nomura and the creative team, how much do you deviate from what is supposed to be the Final Fantasy VII Remake? Or was this one just called Final Fantasy VII Remake because it's the only one that's going to be close to those story events? And next one, it'll be Final Fantasy VII Remake colon whatever the hell we could think of. I guess, like, Benji, what do you think as a returning, like a veteran fan? Do you think they should try and go stick to the main beats, or should they do something else?
Well, I think they should. It's basically because that's what people want to play. And the whole point here is that, as you say, they're trying to have the cake and eat it too. So if you want to retain the fandom, as having just told them that they're all wrong and they should shut up and stop asking for things to service them.
Clarify, that's not something they said in real life. That's an interpretation of the ending.
Yes. Well, I mean, like, okay. I said to you, the phantoms are, we're very close to fandom, and you kill them and tell them go away. I don't think it's a coincidence, but just on this ending, I'll say I thought it was very interesting, and I didn't dislike it in any way. It didn't anger me. I don't care. I'm beyond the point of caring about something like this.
I got all your texts from when you were fighting that final boss.
I was angry at dying, but I wasn't angry at what happened, because I think it's interesting. I think it's a chance to see these characters reinterpreted in a new way, some new scenarios. Oh, I'm excited to find out what happens next. I think it's less genius and more disingenuous. Like I said, they've sold the game on the basis of being a remake and then delivered something slightly different. And I also felt that, like, the very last chapter, as soon as you go through the portal on the bridge, it did feel as though a page out of Kingdom Hearts 3, the script had accidentally been shuffled in the Final Fantasy VII Remake. It was like, it was completely discordant with everything that had came before and the bits that had came slightly afterwards. And it was almost just a way of effectively saying, right, well, a contrivance to say, right, okay, let's get this thing out of the way done now so we can have a blank slate going forward, you know. But I don't think it was necessary to create a tabula rasa in such a way. They could have just changed it without excusing it and said, well, just accept it's different. If you enjoy it, fair enough. Instead, they've made this really divisive finish. But I think it's going to put quite a lot of people off, because they're going to go into the second game thinking, well, it might be absolutely nothing to do with what I want.
The thing that makes me, actually, I was going to ask you, Josh, when did you realize or get the feeling that they were straying from the canon? Like, obviously, you hadn't played the original, so when did it set in that they were deviating so much? Is it just because it was so tonally jarring going through time and space?
Yeah, I mean, that was like the big sort of clue that everything had just gone completely wacky, and this probably wasn't in the original. But also, like, kind of, I do think it was well teased throughout with the introduction of, like, the phantoms and stuff, because I didn't know if they were in the original or if they weren't. I always thought every time they appeared, it resulted in some really cool, interesting moments that I didn't kind of expect. And I love, mm-hmm. I love just in general narratives that sort of clash against kind of destiny and predestination and stuff like that, where you have a kind of set fate and then the characters kind of destroy that or go off mm-hmm. path, and then something's kind of new and exciting and fresh. Mm-hmm.
There was a bit of misdirection there as well, because I think the Phantoms, they tried to conflate them with the chaps,
we should say
the chaps in the robes.
In it.
Yes, the Whispers, sorry. But do you think they tried to conflate those with the Sephiroth men in the robes, tried to make you feel like they were one in the same thing? For me personally, at first I thought, oh, well, it's just, they've just reinterpreted those characters and it's not going to mean anything. But then I think at one point, I can't remember it's when Cloud first had his flashback of Twigs. Mm-hmm. I can see what's going to happen here, and mm-hmm. it turned out that was the case, and I didn't mind.
Oh, dude, I had no idea what was going on with those men in robes. I have absolutely no idea. Sephiroth stuff. It's genuinely.
Right now, we'll talk about Sephiroth in a bit, but right now, what do you think those dudes with the numbers on their arms are?
I don't know.
That's good. Because I think
it's got to be linked with like the experiments that Shinra have been doing, like underground and stuff. Yes,
No.
All but the soldiers, because it's. I don't know. I'm just shouting things out.
It's a question, by the way. Just this is a tangent. Now, do you remember we had to all go through that 5-hour-long dungeon that Hojo's drum back just made us all want to kill ourselves?
Yep.
Yeah. So they have this huge facility in Shinra HQ. It's like it's just about 900 floors. Full of enemies and testing apparatus and laboratories and things like that. So why do they also have an underground lab? In this one.
Well, you know, no, they do. They flesh that out in terms of that they're experimenting with different things that come from different parts of Midgar. So I guess because of where they're located.
They've got a pretty well established transportation network. I'm sure they could get some like transport.
You can't transport a behemoth. On the back of a train. One of the things I was going to pivot into is like Sephiroth. I guess just in general, like Josh, what are your thoughts on Sephiroth? Because I was trying to, when I was going through it first time, when I'm being critical about it, I really don't like the way they handle Sephiroth in this at all. And I think they lose a lot of his most iconic scenes, or they redo them in a much worse way. I just want to see what you think of Sephiroth being that, like he has this assumption of, they even said before release, like, you know, everybody knows about Cloud and Sephiroth. So we're just going to just lead with him. He's not going to be a mystery. We're not going to build up to him. Whereas in the original game, he's not even in Midgar. And the only thing you see is his sword sticking out the back of the Shinra president, which I always thought was a better way to do it. But what was your thoughts on Sephiroth?
I feel very weird about this because for the most of the game, I thought he was done really well. And then I logged online and realized that everyone thought I was wrong about that take, because when he first turns up and he's kind of mysterious and he's haunting Cloud and there's a weird connection between the two, it is in part thanks to the great soundtrack, because every time he appeared, I felt like he was properly intimidating and imposing and felt grand and threatening and big and evil. And I wanted to know how he filtered into the plot. I didn't think we would see him in the flesh in this part of the game. But then when he turns up towards the end, all of that for me was kind of undone, because I didn't understand who he was or his role in the narrative. And then when he turns up at the end, it becomes like an active agent in it. And he is killing, you know, like the president and stuff. And he's ripping a hole in time and space. That felt to me so disconnected from the main thrust of the narrative that came before, that while it was cool to look at and it still did feel grand, I was so deeply confused about why this happened, when it happened, and how it happened, when it happened.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we actually did see Sephiroth. I don't think that was a physical manifestation at the end. I think it was just for Deus Ex Machina, literally a god from above just parachuting in, basically for the sake of playing One Winged Angel. But also,
they have that scene where they when he's climbing on the top of the big tower on top of Shinra HQ, and then Cloud looks again, and it's actually the clone guy.
Yeah.
And you have the pointless shoehorn battle with Sephiroth. Does he just run off like a fanny? Is that what's happened there?
Well, they go to the edge of creation after he gets defeated.
I just got the impression it was an interpretation of Sephiroth that you were fighting, not the actual man, which would that's commensurate with a lot of things that we saw in the original game.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, for me, if you go along with the whole, there's so much evidence that this is the Sephiroth from the original game and from Advent Children. There's just so much stuff. Like whether you look at the way that Rubrum, Krakeo, and Viridi fight, the final forms, the way that they fight lines up with the animations that the Kadaj and the other kids have in Advent Children, and the idea that Harbinger is actually Sephiroth, yada yada, whatever. If you go with that stuff, then it means that his willpower is the thing keeping him alive, which is what was in the supplementary materials for Advent Children.
It also means lots of people have to watch Advent Children.
Well, maybe that's got all of this all along, is to bolster the sales of Advent Children. Eventually we'll get a Spirits Within sequel. We'll have to go back to that. But I guess in terms of another thing as well, actually, next to Sephiroth, is Josh, what do you think or know about Genova?
I don't know anything.
So I thought they did a really bad job of... I mean, you don't get Genova details until, again, after Midgar. It's part of the Sephiroth reveal, so I guess they want you to ask questions. It kind of mimics that.
Quite a lot of those details are hidden in side quests as well. They're not up front.
But I mean, even at the end when, like, the scene, Josh, you'll know the scene at the end of the 7 remake when you go to fight, it's when you're going to go to the rooftops and Sephiroth has taken Genova's head or taken Genova in general. And there's all that goop, there's all that alien goop all over the floor. And it's all quite like kind of haunted and mysterious and whatever's going on. That scene in the original is all blood and it leads to the same fight. But it's the whole thing where Sephiroth has butchered all the different people that are living inside the Shinra Tower, working in the Shinra Tower, and that leads to the sword on the back of the president and everything like that. So they try and have that same scene, but I don't know. For me, in the remake, I don't think that they do enough to tease what Genova actually is. I don't even think they include it in the flashback bit when you get to see that augmented reality presentation where you see all about the history of the planet. Like, as far as I know, Genova's not in the remake hardly at all, apart from like two scenes.
I'm completely lost at the moment, to be honest. I don't know what any of this stuff is.
Literally, Josh, the only clue you would have, having played that game, I'm not going to reveal it, obviously, but the only clue that you could know what Genova is if you have a strong Roman Catholic or Hebrew background and you can take any interpretation on them. Because there's absolutely nothing else there to guess what Genova actually is. Which I suppose it shouldn't be, but then you need to question why on earth am I fighting this as a boss?
Well, and especially when you spend so much time in that final drum area as well, like, which is at the center of it is Genova, but then you never find out.
Just remind me, does Sephiroth refer to Genova as his mother at all? As he previously in the original at this stage?
I don't think so. I think they're keeping that for the flashbacks.
The first time you fought Genova in the original was on a boat, wasn't it?
When you go to the Costa del Sol, I think. Yeah.
I think so. You fight
at the very top of Shinra Tower, that whole thing where you fight like a part of it there.
That's right,
There's like more for them to tease. But yeah, I mean, this kind of answers the question as to like, it's weird because Josh, you find it satisfying that you don't know, or does it just seem like they just undercooked it?
Oh, it's infuriating, like, and how much is left open or assumes your knowledge. Like, it's totally fine. I can totally accept that this might not be, you know, for me, that's okay. But the assumption of knowledge there, it's in part kind of a little bit insulting, just because I feel like they can't tell a story, if that makes sense. I can't get away with this feeling like just part of a whole, and it was a really enjoyable part of a whole, but narratively, man, like, I just don't think the arc's there, and that's why I've uninstalled it, because I can't see myself going back to play it in its entirety, because those threads aren't wrapped up satisfying.
No, totally. The thing that I think they've gone for is if you literally took the original game's Midgar and where the story is at that point and just cleaved it and said, well, how much do you know at this point? How many things are we teasing? You get exactly that amount in terms of like Sephiroth is suddenly an entity at the very end of Midgar. Genova is suddenly a thing. What the hell's going on? End. And, you know, that's why they left the remake. But obviously, like you said, it doesn't feel satisfying. But
I was just going to say there's another good reason as well for some of the teasers, and it's just pure fan service.
Yes.
Like, I know Josh was confused when he saw the cat in the crown.
The cat in the crown, man. Like, what? What?
To someone, like, being invested in that moment, like, literally the plates just fell, hundreds or thousands of people have just died. Here's a small cat with a little crown on that, to be honest, I did pop for and went, oh, my God, it's catchy.
There's a cat in the crown. It's great.
Why there? And also, me and you, Benji, and all the people who know what that is, why? That doesn't even make any sense as
it
to why.
It makes no sense. No, he, the thing, the entity, cats. Whatever's behind it could have a better way of knowing what's happened.
Yes, let's just say, wouldn't be reacting in that way, let's say. That stuff is kind of ridiculous.
In the arse to react in that way.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
It just didn't make any sense.
I had a lesser problem with Red 13 in a similar way, where I knew he was an iconic character because everyone's like, oh, he's so good. But to me, he was just like quite an interesting dog, and that's fine. Like, he was cool in combat. I know, but this game gave me no reason to properly care about him other than that he's an experiment and he's called Red 13 and he looks really cool. Again, it was the feeling like I was missing out on something. And I know how much you love him and you talked about him before launch. And I knew he was coming at some point and he wasn't going to be playable, but it was just that feeling of trying to disconnect what I kind of know, the fragments of knowledge I have from just working in this industry and being friends with you two, like clashing up against the fact that or what the game gives me, you know, and clashing up against the few tidbits and the few pieces of information that are actually in the story itself, this version.
That's 100% totally valid. Like, the stuff with Red, I think I love just seeing his and Barrett's interactions. I think every time they have a little moment, he does a little high five with his tail, or like when he makes him smile in the back of the van and stuff. It's tiny little things, but obviously it is bolstered by a lifetime of fandom. Like you said, it's like he is just like this kind of mildly more interesting dog. And then it's like, oh, I don't know, like in that scene as well, because you get to hang out with him in Hojo's drum thing, you're just waiting for him to pull levers really slowly, and it just, and that whole thing, you know, it's just
so crap at it as well. He's so crap, so slow, and you can throw him over even if there's not a lever, and you have to wait for him to go, oh no, there's no lever, and then he comes back and it's like, oh, what a waste of my time in a section that's already wasting your time so much.
I know what you mean. It's that whole bit was the bit that I mentioned in the review, is the one time they injected some padding that I fundamentally like really didn't like. I just kind of went, oh god, not now. Like, you're literally breaking the pace that you've established. Like, it made no sense at all. And every character character is, well, I guess we have to do this side mission thing. I guess we have to do it because Hojo's got us trapped or whatever. And it's like, I guess we have to test all the Shinra machinery. It was just like, what are you doing? That stuff kind of stood out to me. But yeah, I mean, we should talk about, we talked about Sephiroth and general stuff going forward. But Josh, are you still excited about the sequel? The fact that you deleted it straight away, it's shocking to me.
Yeah, it's I can go back to what I said before, where I'm more excited about what they do next than I necessarily am about this game. Not that I think this game's a whole write-off, because I love especially the characters that were established here. Like, all of them I've managed to fall in love with even by the end. Even, you know, people like Barrett, who I didn't think I was going to enjoy first.
And even Chadley.
Why don't you like Chadley?
Oh, it was Chadley.
Exactly. He's the little VR man who gives you a VR headset and he gives you the material.
Yeah, is my boy. Chadley kept popping up with new VR missions for me to do, and I thought, you legend, I don't know how you're getting around all of
this. He's a magician.
I tell you what, as well, you guys will not know the full extent of Mr. Chadley, because you'll not finish the VR stuff. And once you've finished all the VR stuff on hard, you get a little reveal about him, and he's not what you think, which is interesting. Cheeky. But
another thing, they just leave out the game, then yeah.
Well, it's there if you want to get it. If you don't delete it and ting, but it depends.
Is he a heartless?
Well, do you guys want to know? I'll tell you.
Tell me.
Deleted this. Anyway. He's an android at the end of it. He's a combat android developed by Hojo to go out and test various soldiers and stuff. And
it does feel like there's quite a lot of stuff from other games in this game. That shouldn't be there.
what does that remind you of?
Kingdom Hearts final boss. You've got your Xeno Saga android. The dog was in the original one, but there's no explanation for why there's suddenly a talking dog and everyone's fine with that. It's like, oh, you talk.
Well, they kind of know that he's an experiment. In terms of influences, the whole game structure is very much Yakuza. Apart from Yakuza's never had that much padding before. It was always fun. But I was going to mention in terms of cast and sequel stuff and are we excited and things like that. Josh, do you feel like, because one of the biggest questions I had when I was reviewing it was, would someone still get it in terms of why Aerith is a huge deal or Tifa is a big deal? And in terms of, like, you know, why you, like you said that you kind of fell in love with them, but like you get them as, because one of the problems that me and Benji also had is that we kind of felt like they were reduced to just sort of glorified waifus. They're just there for Cloud. They're thirsty for Cloud 24/7. And elements of that are in the original. But to us, when we first went through, I don't want to speak for Benji like too much, but we mentioned this to ourselves. You know, it kind of felt like all these close-ups of their faces, all this twee sort of over-the-top energetic charismatic approach to Cloud, and he's just fobbing them off left, right and center. He kind of comes across like a bit of a closed off a-hole the first time through to me.
On that point, I've been replaying the original game, and it doesn't take long, but it takes a little longer for Aerith to discover that there's more to Cloud than the exterior suggests. And she even suggests, she says in one of the famous sequences in the game that she wants to know the real him. But at this point in the game, she already seems to have formed this like unbreakable bond with him and wants to, you know, as
the same. She's the original her from the first game.
All the other characters as well, for some reason.
I know. Well, that's the thing. So, yeah, Josh, did you kind of, you said that you fell in love with him and stuff, but it, like, how did you come down on like the general sort of, I don't know, I guess like relationships between the party, and like, did it feel like they were just playing on that established connection that they already had from the original game or the fandom had, or did it feel like it was grown from the ground up?
A bit of both, especially with Aerith, like you said. I do think there is an element, like you said, of her being at least knowledgeable about what happens in the original game and already kind of having a connection with Cloud that he doesn't necessarily know about, because those parts are a touch awkward. So there is definitely some of that, but I think even on their own terms, they do a pretty good job with it. I was won over by all of them, and I thought all of the relationships felt quite, you know, real and earned towards the end. Like, I thought I would get really annoyed with Cloud being this kind of closed off asshole for most of the game, because I know from speaking to you guys that's not really how he is in the original, but I thought that was one of the few arcs that kind of felt finished towards the end of the game. And if there is a through line in it, I do think it's Cloud going from this kind of shut off mercenary type to having this bunch of friends. You know, I lived for the moments when you're with Aerith and you're going through a bunch of monsters and she's trying to high five you, then Cloud's not going to high five. And the pit in my stomach when he went to do it and she didn't do it. I was like, no. The fact that it made me feel that way, I was like, that's a cool little moment, and I'm pleased they fleshed those ideas out.
That was the bit in that exact that collapsed highway is absolute dreck anyway, but that bit when you have to do the high fives, because it would have been so many hours in, I was like, how many times are they going to play the card where someone is energetic and charismatic towards him and he fobs them off directly to their face? That actually really annoyed me, but then they kind of brought it back with the really slow high five, and I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. But I don't know, for that high five scene in particular, I was like, Cloud's not actually like a rude a-hole, he just thinks he's supposed to be a cold mercenary. There's like, it's a fine line, but I always thought it came across better in the original, that he's like playing the part of this, you know, like super cool mercenary, and he's like, he flips into the train when they do the first mission and stuff like that. Whereas like in the remake, I was just like, you're a complete dick.
I do think it comes across is like him playing a part for a lot of it. I think the flashbacks to him as a kid help it, because he almost does feel like a kid wearing his dad's clothes, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that's quite intentional to have him think that he needs to be emotionally unavailable or emotionally closed off, because, you know, that's the way he doesn't get hurt. And then kind of see that crack, but him trying to keep the facade up for quite a while. I do think they did quite well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the writing in general has been praised like across the board. I didn't find that. And Benji, I know you were the same. When we like both went through it, we were like, oh my God, the script seems worse. Is that something you'd still think after finishing it?
I think I would, yeah. I thought it was a little bit hyperbolic at times. It was not subtle enough for my liking. There's just some areas where characters aren't necessarily as human as should be. You know, like after big, huge emotional events that would have very like significant impact on your psyche and on your feelings. And then but just sort of brush them off within a couple of minutes and say, oh, that's sad. Okay, let's move on. Like there's and everybody's really concerned about the plot all the time. And I think the times when the writing's strong is when they are doing the human interactions, when Barrett and Cloud are sort of having a little back and forth when you're going on the missions. And some of the stuff with Aerith in house, and I think the stuff with Elmira as well is very strong, but a lot of that was taken directly from the original game. But on the whole, yeah, I think it could have been, I don't know, just a lot tighter.
I think it is another thing that comes from just like it is strange, because like in terms of like favorite party loadouts and favorite characters and stuff, for the vast majority of the game you're given a specific loadout of characters, and you have to, you know, you're either Cloud and Aerith or you're Cloud, Tifa and Barret for the vast majority. It's only when you do the optional VR stuff that you can actually pick a party, and that obviously comes from segmenting Midgar overall in terms of just those characters are only with each other, and it's that for me there's so much reduced party banter. Like I remember thinking that it really came into its own in like chapter 14, but at that point you're like 18 hours in terms of like, you know, multiple characters bouncing off each other.
I'm very confused, because especially towards the end when they're essentially on the big mission together and the game kept contriving reasons to split them up into groups of two or three. Like there was a part where there's like three of them and Barret's just off pissing about with like Red 13 for no reason. I'm like, why? What stops them from putting all those characters together? I didn't quite understand that. I didn't know whether that's because they that way in the original or...
No, yeah. I think it's an intentional design choice to try and force you into different configurations of the characters. So it offers a different tactical challenge. I think that was purely the reason.
Yeah, they're just for me, it's that group banter is one of the reasons I adore Final Fantasy VII, the original one. It's just there is that group chemistry. Like each character is so unique, and they have so much to bounce off each other with. So I kind of missed that. It is strange because overall, when we talk about the highs and lows of the game overall, Josh, you loved the most, I think, the middle chunk with Aerith when things sort of calmed down. It was more of a character piece, and you weren't that massive on the intro and the outro. Whereas that's the complete opposite for me. I thought the middle was a huge drag, and I adore the intro and the outro.
Well, it's strange. I thought from a gameplay perspective, like the last 10 hours or so were so weirdly placed and was such a slog that it kind of ruined a lot of the love that I had for it in the middle section. I do think the middle section is the strongest around the wall market stuff, but I would be lying if I didn't say like the ambitions of the ending didn't bring it back a little bit. When it first kicked off, I was a bit frustrated with the gameplay in the story itself, kind of like threw me in without explaining too much, which was kind of left me without a paddle in a way, whereas the end I really enjoyed where the story was going, even if I am annoyed that I didn't wrap much up. But that was sort of contrasted with the most frustrating gameplay sections of the whole thing in my eyes, which does frustrate you quite a lot. Like for me, this game could have happily been 20 hours, you know what I mean? Like you could have cut a lot of the padding out and not lost anything, because the story stuff is so good. And it's not like the parts where you're slowly walking around towns with Aerith are the problem to me. It is just those elongated sections where you're looking for key cards or you're having to go through three different rooms to unlock a door. It feels archaic and like it's wasting your time, which is the worst part.
It is archaic, but it's also, if points to me like a degree of fear about the fandom on Square Enix part, which is why I felt like we couldn't confidently release a very, very, very good 20-hour game. We have to release a very good 20-hour game wrapped up in a quite boring 30-hour game. It's also why I've come up with a reason to change the plot instead of just going ahead and doing it. You know what I mean? It's like they're so... I understand why they'd be afraid of backlash given how long the game's been in development and given people are expecting more than 20-hour game after 6 years. That's being billed as final, already annoyed that it's been split into parts and then, you know, you're effectively getting 4 hours of the original. But it would be longer if it had just, you know, been very a lot braver, perhaps. And like you said, cut out those things and just did what we wanted from that without coming up with a contrivance for it.
Mm-hmm. They did discuss that stuff tons as well in terms of like, don't worry, it's going to be a proper, a quote-unquote proper JRPG. Yeah, we're going to make sure there's enough gameplay in there.
One of the things in the advertising blurb is it's as long as a regular Final Fantasy. Well, it's not, for a start. It's about half the size, but except for Final Fantasy 15, which just falls off a cliff after 15 hours anyway. It's not, length isn't better, is it? It's not stronger for it.
No, I think, and that's the thing, if they'd made it more focused, I don't know whether that would have exacerbated all the problems of like, okay, so where's part two? Like, I don't know whether you would have been left hanging in more negative.
Is that it? And that's obviously the problem I had. So it's difficult. I think maybe we've got the balance slightly wrong.
It's strange because having now gone through hard and got the platinum and literally my hour count is 98 at this point, which is ludicrous. I think most of that is because I've never done a platinum before. I've just never done one and I've never made a plan to get one. So I was rerunning stuff over and over and over again. Having now done that though, like obviously I've got my fill of it and I've managed to get that much time out of it. But my initial finish time was 30 hours. I don't know what it was for you guys.
That's about 31, yeah.
I didn't feel like me.
Yeah.
Okay, because like Final Fantasy VII, the original one, I clocked in, I think, well, I don't know how many hours it was the first time, but when I replayed it last year, it was about 35. So it matches up, but it's not the same. If you did everything in Final Fantasy VII in terms of, you know, Master Summon Materia and Knights of the Round and Golden Chocobos and stuff, you'd be nearer like 100 hours for the base game if it's just seeing all those things once, as opposed to rerunning stuff to make up the runtime, which is like a, I mean, I guess a meaningful difference because that's...
It is meaningful as well because... Final Fantasy VII, the original, you finish it after 30 hours, 35 as you say. Mm-hmm. You do all the additional stuff. It isn't just replaying the game again, but harder. It is actually another 30 hours of meaningful content to do.
Yeah, which I guess might be something that they'll do in the next one. It's just like you said, it's maybe the point, like the result of like slightly troubled development or like mixed expectations or even things like Tetsuya Nomura not realizing he's the director until he sees the trailer for it in his own office. Just stuff like that that point to them sort of stitching the parachute as they on the way down kind of thing. But yeah, we might as well end on some quick sequel stuff. What do you guys want to see from the next one? Is it story-based stuff? Is it gameplay-based stuff?
Well, you want to see? You know, Josh mentioned that about he's frustrated with Red 13 not being explored in any particular detail. Now, you and I know what's going to happen with him and some of the story. And having replayed it again recently, some of it's quite naff. Just his granddad is inexplicable. His father, there's a very, very, very melodramatic sequence involving that. So I think we've got a chance now to get rid of some of that awful stuff.
You said this before we started recording that you're going back through it at the minute and you're not loving it as much. I went through it last year and it completely held up. I still adore it. That whole thing at Cosmo Canyon with Red is one of my favorite parts in the whole game.
The dungeon that precedes it, I have to say, is very uninspiring.
I always thought it was really hard back in the day, but then I kind of bruised it.
There's one character, I mean, it's three main characters Josh hasn't even met yet. There's one who is going to get a complete overhaul, I can guarantee. Sid.
Oh, yeah, they need to fix his dialogue considerably.
Yeah, he's problematic, let's say.
Just a full-on abuser, to be honest. It's not very good.
I don't think it's going to be linear. I think it's going to be sort of vignettes that you can visit in any order.
I think they'll do a like World of Final Fantasy or Kingdom Hearts 3 style overworld where you've got more animated versions of cities and you're flying to them and then do the world map that way. I think it's the only way you can really do an entire world map.
If you think about what immediately follows when you leave Midgar, it's the sense of being out in the world on your own and going to discover as you're chasing Sephiroth. Well, Sephiroth's already been up front. You've beat him now. They can't do the beat with the Midgar Zolom because that's meaningless. The whole Mithril Mines will be meaningless. Yeah, even I guess Janon is a huge set piece, so that'll be the first part of call, I would imagine. Immediately out of the game.
I honestly think they'll open it in flashback. I think you'll get the Cloud Sephiroth flashback because everyone, like the likes of Josh, are like, who the hell is this guy? What the hell's going on? I think you answer that immediately by doing the flashback.
The whole thing in Calm, do you think that'll be...
Yeah, I think you do that and then you like come out of that flashback and the whole team's just resting in Calm and it's like, okay, we need to crack on.
I mentioned earlier how this feels like a mishmash of different games. Did you always think Calm felt like it was just took out of a completely different JRPG and just... like slapping.
Oh, well, yeah, but that's because it's such a contrast to Midgar. Like, you've got this little homely town.
It's only about 50 yards away from Midgar. So
and I don't know. I like that it does feel, literally, it is its name. And after you've just finished Midgar, it's the best place to just chill for a bit and actually relax. But yeah, Josh, as a newcomer to the whole thing, what do you want from the sequel? Do you want story details or gameplay?
I want them to change the gameplay quite considerably. I don't know whether either make it, not the gameplay itself, the level design, let's say, and then the pacing. I want them to fix that. Either make it more linear and don't put all the padding in, or make it kind of, you know, bigger and open world. And if it takes a bit longer to come out, then it takes a bit longer to come out. But as long as they fulfill the promise of this ending, I will be totally fine with it. Because at the moment, like I said, I love it conceptually. I love the doors it opens, and I love what they can now do to Final Fantasy VII, the original. Because I will play the original before I get to part 2.
You won't.
I will. It's made me interested in it. And going forward, I want to know what they change more in depth. But if they don't deliver those, if they don't deliver any kind of satisfying conclusions to any of the threads that they brought up here, and they are still stringing us along a little bit, I will be disappointed if the grandiosity of the finale suddenly gets very small and meaningless.
I think that based on that idea of replaying the original after you've played the remake or beforehand or whatever, just because of how crazy this thing's new ending is, it still resets everybody and makes everybody not know what's coming next, which I still think is the best card it plays.
What absolutely wouldn't have been the case had they just went with a 1-for-1 remake is it's no longer a spoiler to play the original. Now what you're doing is you're trying to draw the comparisons and see how things are deviating. That's really interesting. Just do you think maybe that they shot the wad a little bit early on some things in this first part? Like, by the end, you had the most powerful magic spells. You didn't have your face Sephiroth, you had one winged angel. I know it's only VR, but you're still fighting like Behemoth and things like that. Where did it go from here? Are we going to have to reset all the characters back to a base?
I don't know how the hell they address the leveling problem because I'm level 50 across the board and everyone's on 9999 health.
I think it's going to be a hard reset like in Xenosaga Part 2, for example.
Like, I still have to. They need to give you something to work towards. There are obviously like way more complex materia systems to bring in. Stuff that you don't realize how much you need specific chained materia setups until you play on hard, where you're like your MP recovery isn't a thing and you don't get to use items. So you have to use prayer and HP recovery and MP recovery.
Yeah, so the game gives you a lot of materia. Some of it, like late level materia, would be quite useful, but you're still getting early level weapons that don't necessarily have the slots to accommodate.
Like, you can unlock them though.
Well, I suppose, but in the actual, like, just in the course of the main game itself, so you end up with a lot. You don't really get a lot of opportunity to use materia to its fullest, I found.
That's true for a normal playthrough. That's why I loved going back through it on hard. It's strange because I still can't tell if it's a positive or a negative. Personally, I think it's a positive that if you explore more of the game, you play it again on hard, you discover this whole other depth of the combat that relies on that.
Yeah, see, that sounds like that to me, and that's where the game would naturally go from this point forth, but only if it could somehow carry over what you've got from this game into the next, which I just don't feel is possible.
Oh, they have to do some sort of save transfer thing, but
it'll probably be cross-platform as well, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, I guess they're...
In fact, I can't even imagine it being on the PS4.
That'd be really weird. I guess they know that the PS5 is backwards compatible anyway, so I guess you just release it.
So I actually release a PS4 game on the PS5.
Yeah, and it just auto-up-reses on PS5. I don't know. They're in a hell. The whole thing's this weirdest position thing, and they're so much aware of it. Like, I mean, Aerith talks about boundless, terrifying freedom ahead of her, and at the very end it says the unknown journey continues. It's never been referred to as the unknown journey before, unless I'm missing something. And it just feels like they're just going like, we don't know, we're doing what we can. Please come with us.
So just on Aerith, by the way, is that it does touch upon this when Elmer is telling the story, is that she did have visions of the future originally.
Yes.
That is not necessarily a new thing. So it's possible that she had those visions before and it might still not be averted, the fate everybody's expecting. But this is a way to give people, like, because we know for 23 years, one of the biggest video game urban legends is, can you revive Aerith? How do you do it? Everybody's wanted to, everybody's tried, and now it's given people hope that in this version, maybe you can, but maybe you can't.
Well, that's the stuff that I think directly like plays into all the fan theories and the reasons that they're teasing you with these particular scenes, and they're setting that stuff up. And literally, I mean, Sephiroth says you have 7 seconds until the end. 7 seconds is the window that Sephiroth kills someone in the first game, and it just seems like that's what they're directly addressing, that like he's fully aware of everything he's done in the past. But yeah, you can let us know anything down in the comments below for the video version. Come find us on Twitter to leave questions on the hashtag WCGP, and we can carry forward with this conversation. We might do a follow-up, we might do more predictions and bits and bobs, because clearly there's an absolute ton to talk about. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
And Benjamin Richardson.
Thank you. Goodbye.
I'll catch you next time. Bye.
See ya.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.